So our next speaker will be is Carolyn Young, and she's from the Noble Foundation, which I know a little bit about, so it's an interesting organization. I know they have a particular interest in forage crops and alfalfa and a few other things, so this makes some sense. She's been interested in working in where am I? I'm lost my list here. She's been working on plant microbe interactions for quite a while, and so this is a natural extension of that work, the biome issues. So with that, Carolyn, come on up.
I'm going to try and keep track as well. Okay, well, thanks very much for the invitation to speak at this meeting. It's a delight to be here. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the work we do with microorganisms that impact production of forage crops. But first of all, for those of you who aren't familiar with the Noble Foundation, I just wanted to put a slide up here just to let you know who we are. We're a privately funded agricultural research centre based in Ardmore, Oklahoma, and this little, if I can get the mouse working, that little red dot is indicating where Ardmore, Oklahoma is. We've set up our mission is basically to advance agricultural science, and in particular for our area of the Southern Great Plains. But the challenges that we have across the Southern Great Plains actually impact many other crop-related communities as well. For example, there's a huge concentration gradient of rain going across the state of Oklahoma, and so we quite often experience drought, or as it happened in this year, we've experienced floods. So we've seen a lot over the years. So this gives you an idea of our land usage, and I think that this is a really amazing figure to actually have together, where you can see the areas where we've got high people density in black. Ardmore, Oklahoma is not one of those. You can see a little dot there. but what you can also tell is that our area is mostly set up with grass and pasture, woodland, and then this beautiful bright green streak going through here is a wheat belt, including a little rye belt, which is the little pink stripe there. And for those of you who are kind of wondering what's that red blob hovering over Lubbock, that is cotton growing area. So our forage production systems in our area, the current system is really set up with a winter annual and then a warm season perennial. So we've got a winter wheat, for example, is what a lot of people will grow. It will be grown as a graze and grain option, so farmers can graze. And if grain is worthwhile, then they can also take the animals off and get the grain production. Bermuda grass is very big, but any warm season grasses, some of its native range in our area as well. But there's a problem. And the problem is that we've got some forage gaps in this area. And what happens is the farmers and ranchers are spending a lot of money buying in hay for their animals to eat. So we wanted to try and solve that problem, and we came up with a concept called Forage 365. And that actually brings in a couple of different or extra systems in here. So we have alfalfa, so coming in kind of supporting on the flanks of the Bermuda grass, and tall fescue as a perennial cool season grass. And although it still looks like there is a gap there, if we stockpile the tall fescue, we can actually bridge that gap. We're probably never going to be forage 365, 365 days of the year, but we can aim to get as close to that as possible. So forage 365 was born. And as I mentioned, there's alfalfa, winter wheat, tall fescue, and Bermuda grass are the main species that we're interested in. So all the scientists got together at the Noble Foundation and we came up with some concepts that we thought were really important to make sure that Forage 365 could be possible. And some of the things that we were interested in was breeding for alfalfa, a lot of focus on low input agriculture, so phosphorus, nitrogen and water, the growth and development of plants, so looking at root architecture in particular, the plant-microbe interactions, both with beneficial and pathogenic microbes, and then the plant-animal interactions. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some of the programs related to the beneficial and the pathogenic systems that are involved here. So just to introduce you to some of the players, we have Kelly Craven, Michael Advardi, myself, and Karen Mysore, and we're all the people who work with the microbes, okay? There are other scientists at the Nobel Foundation, but we're the microbe lovers. So I'm going to talk to you today a little bit about some of Kelly's work on Sebacina, because there's really graphic pictures here that give you that big wow moment. I'm also going to tell you a little bit about some cool season, some endophytes and cool season grasses. And I'm going to end with a root rot disease and sort of looking forward to the future with our understanding of that. So just starting off, let's think about endophytes. And endophytes have come up today, but I'm talking about a very specific endophyte. And these are the endophytes that are found in cool season grasses. And what I'm showing you here is a stand of tall fescue that is either endophyte infected or endophyte free. And you can see that the endophyte infected stand is persisting much greater than the endophyte free stand. And in fact, actually, that's what we want, is we want persistence. And when we're breeding in our area, that's one of the traits that we breed for. The other two traits are persistence and persistence. So they are the main features that we're breeding for in our area. So if that endophyte is going to provide it, then it's something that we want to carry along with our breeding cycle. So what are these endophytes? For those of you in the audience who aren't familiar, these are Epichloe species. They had another name. There is the new one fungus, one rule that's going around, and our favourite species have been renamed. So Epichloe, what you're looking at here is Epichloe cinephila, that's in a tall fescue grass, and it has got a cyan blue labelled protein in it. So you can see it growing in the meristem here of the plant, and it grows up into the tillers. But what's really more intriguing about this endophyte is that it's a dominant species that is seed transmitted. So it will grow up into the developing seed heads, or seeds, and can be transmitted that way. In fact, it has a closed cycle. It doesn't have a life cycle outside of the plant. It's solely retained within the plant. So it's really amazing to be able to use this, or it's great that we can use this within agriculture. And it is actually utilised in many of the cool season grasses for forage, such as tall fescue and perennial ryegrass. So let's think about tall fescue. And tall fescue gets a bit of a bad name, a bit of a bad rap in the United States. But hopefully you'll all walk away and you're going to be excited about the new technologies that's available there. So tall fescue is very dominant in the eastern part of the United States. And it's thought that it originally came from the Souda farm in Kentucky. And this was seen as a fabulous grass that was growing under some pretty extreme conditions at that stage. Kentucky 31, a tall fescue cultivar, was essentially released and was well distributed. And you can see, like I say, this distribution pattern across the United States. But after a while, people noticed that there was poor animal performance. And in fact, then it was defined as what's called fescue toxicosis. And this is something that the animals were really suffering on tall fescue. So the forage, the grass was great. It was growing really well. But the animals weren't doing so well. And it turns out that there was an endophyte associated with that particular grass. And more to the point, that endophyte, ergovaline, an ergot alkaloid, was causing the toxicity on the grazing animals. So this toxicity comes in, the animals, it's a vasoconstrictor, so the animals are their veins are constricting, the blood flow going to their limbs, the extremes, they'll lose the tips of their ears, the switch of their tail, and things like that. And this is in very extreme cases. But more importantly, it's a toxin, and so the animals are just not feeling so great on it, okay? I know if I was going to eat a toxin, I wouldn't be feeling so great. So the whole idea behind this is that you have a great performance because you have the fungus in the grass, but this fungus is the one that's producing a toxin. And you can think about this toxin, if we want to put an ecologist hat on, you can think about this toxin as a bioprotective alkaloid of the grass. Okay, it's just not so good for the actual animals that are grazing it. Now, you can get rid of the endophyte, and unfortunately in some locations, if you do that, then you see that figure I showed you before where you actually don't have great persistence there. But more importantly, or more recently, there's been a lot of efforts looking for non-ergot alkaloid producing endophytes. And these are natural strains that are just incapable of producing the ergot alkaloids. And we know that because there's been a lot of molecular biology that's done. We actually understand the capability behind the ergot alkaloid production. And then moving forward, we're actually even able to sequence draft genomes of these endophytes. And we can establish new endophyte-infected cultivars. So we have at the Noble Foundation, we have a breeding program, and we're incorporating endophytes, but not the ones that are producing the toxins that are bad for the animals. And you'll notice at the bottom here that I've put this sort of some components about this whole cycle of understanding tool fescue, which just relates to this multidisciplinary research that's required to understand something like this. So just to sort of look back at this, what a difference a strain makes, and just to sort of summarise that, we can see the animals here. We've got animals grazing a non-toxic, one that's unable, it's still endophyte infected, it's tool fescue, but not able to produce ergovaline, and those animals are healthy and happy versus the ones that are on an ergovaline producing pasture or with an endophyte producing ergovaline. They've got rough hair coats, they're just not doing as well. They actually had lower average daily gains and everything. So what a difference a strain can make. But here's the issue. We actually need to educate people about this if we want the technology to be taken up. That's one of the most important things that needs to be done. We need to encourage the farmers that it's a good idea to go out and replace their pastures with these new cultivars that are out there, not for the sake of their pastures, but for the sake of the animals that they're producing on their pastures. So I want to finish that little section here with my little kind of idea of the phytobiomes related to tool fescue, and just thinking about this, where we've got the grass that's endophyte infected, it has effect on herbivory. I didn't talk about the insect side of things, but there are other alkaloids that have protection, help against insect protection. It also helps with some abiotic stresses, but then we've got to think about the whole system, as what's been mentioned before. It's not just about, let's put this plant in the ground, let's make sure we have the whole system working correctly. Okay, so let me move on to some of Kelly's work, and you'll see why this, I think, is really exciting. He's been working with a new symbiont that is to help improve plant production. The symbiont's called Sebacina vermifera, and it's associated with mycorrhizal with orchids. It's a mycorrhizal, an orchid mycorrhizal association. What's great about this mycorrhizal is that it actually can be cultured in the lab, and you can see it growing on the plate here. And it has an extraordinarily diverse host range. It can go on, I think, every single plant host he has put this mycorrhizae on, it has actually hadn't formed an association with it, and most often a beneficial association, because it's seen to improve plant biomass. This gives you an idea of what we're looking at. So just this is a little lab study. I thought it was kind of cute. This is for those of you who are lab rats like me. This is just using a 5 mil tip that's stuff filled with bentonite clay that has the Sebacina associated with it. And this is a high throughput way that they can look at the associations. But you can see here on the right where we've got with Sebacina and the root biomass that has been produced with, and this is actually a wheat that's there. So you can see the benefits of that. In addition, this is some work he's done with switchgrass, where you can see the difference between, now we're looking at a range of Sebacina isolates versus the control, and the difference in the root biomass. Now, for those of you who are familiar with switchgrass, it's very difficult to establish in the field. So anything that we can utilise that would help with establishment and speed that up is a huge benefit. Kelly's not here at this meeting, but I thought it would be good to just put up a couple of the recent publications that he's had on this work as well. Okay, so I want to finish this talk talking about a pathogen. And this is called, the pathogen's called Phymatotrichopsis omnivora, and it causes a root rot disease. What's really intriguing about this pathogen is that it is a pathogen of over 2,000 dicotyledonous plants. And I think that this figure here is gives a classic example of just the power of this pathogen. When you see the dead tree, you see the live monocot, the grass, and then you see the dead alfalfa. Okay? And this pathogen is basically spread out into this field, and this ring of death just kept growing and growing and growing during the summer season. Now, it's not a problem all over the world. It has a very limited area where it's endemic, and it's very much a soil associated. It likes high pH, high calcareous soils, but you can see that it's really a problem in the southwest of the United States and down into Mexico. The disease is not only devastating, but it's also very, very difficult. The pathogen is difficult to work with. It's one of these multinucleated, there's no transformation systems. You can see that sometimes I switch between alfalfa and lucerne there. I was in a meeting in Australia recently, so I wanted to make sure they understood me. It's got a really large genome size, and our initial attempts at sequencing it, and I'm going to preface that with a long time ago, it resulted in just a horrific assembly with way too many contigs for a fungal genome. Now, we're going to revisit that again next year, and I'm pretty sure that the newer technology is not going to leave us with 168,000 contigs. The other problem is that it rapidly loses pathogenicity in the lab, and we actually have to maintain this fungus as a soil culture, which is really very different from how we would normally culture any fungal species in the lab. In fact, actually working with soil cultures is not great. But what it does do is it forms these sclerotia. Here you can see this white mass that's there. Those are sclerotia. And if you imagine those sclerotia are actually out in the soil, out there in the environment, and they are overwintering. They can last for a long period of time. They're viable for a long time. It makes it a very difficult pathogen to get rid of. There has been some success with cotton. So cotton is another one of its hosts. And you can see here with the top guard fungicide, and I think this is work that's predominantly come out of Texas A&M, these flanking regions were treated, and you can see the non-treated area. So you can see that the fungicide is going to be quite helpful when here untreated and treated. But cotton's not grown as a perennial crop. It's grown as an annual system. And this fungicide is applied directly when they plant. And we don't have the ability to do that when we're looking at alfalfa. So we've got to come up with some different systems for success with this fungicide. And we're looking at that at the moment. One of our more exciting things, though, is to take advantage of drones. These unmanned aerial vehicles and taking pictures of it. So let me put this into perspective for you. This here is one shot from the drone. It's high resolution. You can see that the green is where the alfalfa is. And there's some patches that are brown. So this is actually a Roundup Ready alfalfa that was utilised. And so they sprayed out the weeds. So what you're seeing is the dirt. It's either the dirt or the alfalfa. These images get stitched together and create a much bigger image so that we can see the whole field. And this arch here that you're seeing is a central pivot of the total pivot size is 120 acres. And this is just showing you one half of that, so 60 acres of alfalfa. It doesn't look pretty, okay? We've lost a lot of the stand, and that's in June. That's at the beginning of the disease season. Now, one of the things that we did, I had a new postdoc in my lab start at the beginning of this year, and before the season started, he was just desperate to get his hands on the pathogen, and I'm like, you've just got to wait till June, you've just got to wait till June. And he's like, but can't we go and look? And so we went out to the field, and we had a look at some of the plants. And we went into highlighting here the healthy, the disease front, and the survivor area. We went and looked at these plants, and when you look at the roots, we could see that the healthy roots looked nice and healthy. On the disease fronts, they were just full of lesions, absolutely full of lesions. We had no problems detecting the pathogen there. But the survivors were really interesting because they had very different root morphologies going on. And part of it was, you can see sort of in here, they've actually lost their taproot and they've put out a whole bunch more laterals. And we really wanted to get a handle on this to see, is this actually a plant trait that we could select for, or is this just something that is more opportunistic? And if this is a feature of the survival, is this something that is actually a beneficial trait? Because if you think about the long hot summers we have in the Oklahoma and Texas region, maybe this plant, you know, it's not going to die of cotton root rot, but it will die of drought. So we needed to kind of put all of this information together. And we've just started working on this now, so I don't have a lot of details on it, but this is looking at one picture. These are little whiskers that are put into the field, so that was where that white line represents where the disease front was. This is how much the disease moved in just a month, okay? It was somewhere between half a metre and a metre that the disease front moved. And we lost a lot of plants in this time. If we've got assays that we can detect the pathogen in the roots just using PCR, and if we go out into the uninfected area, we can see that pathogen is actually present in that area. And that's not surprising because it must be moving ahead of that disease front. What was surprising, though, is we didn't see as many of those, that root morphology that I had shown you before. And we think that that's in part related to it was a different soil type, and the way that we're doing our sampling. So we're going to try and go back again this year and try and see what's going on and also look back at some of the plants that have survived on this area. We can take all of that imagery as well and we can look at it and overlay it across. So we had in 2014, we had the three flights that went over and we can overlay all of these images and we could see in a standard year, we lost 2.8 metres of our stand. We're talking huge amount of loss. In 2015, we don't have the aerial imagery all analysed yet, but based on the study that was done, the previous study I showed you, we lost around the same amount. So you can imagine that every year, as soon as that disease starts, the farmer is losing 3 metres and 3 metres and 3 metres, okay? And this is kind of what it looks like. So this is they're going from June to August, not at the end of the season. But if you look in these areas here, you can see just how much stand loss we've actually had from this cotton root rot, well, this Phymatotrichopsis omnivora pathogen, this root rot pathogen. This stand here, it was left in 2014 and to go into 2015. And I think the reality was, why? Why did we leave that in? We've barely got enough alfalfa production here. And so this is the sort of thing that we can now do with all of this aerial imaging. And I wish I'd had a sneak peek at some of Jan's slides because I think that picture that she showed with all of the technology there, with the aerial imaging, the sensors, we're going to be running sensors as of next year. We've got some sensors as well across this area. I think it would be great to actually pull all of these pieces together, including our knowledge of what's going on in the soil. We're also going to be trying to set up some studies looking at the community structures that are there and potentially their function, but we're going to start with community structures first. And bringing all of this information there and trying to see, can we utilise that for one of the key things that farmers have a problem with growing alfalfa, if we're going to encourage them, they need to put alfalfa into their system, as they say, it's this pathogen. They don't want to plant alfalfa because of that pathogen. So maybe we can set up a way of looking at their soils and actually saying that, yes, you've got a problem in this particular area. Maybe we can find areas within our own environment with suppressive soils and things like that. But we had to start somewhere, and this is our first attempt at doing this. The aerial imaging. And I mean, I just think the pictures are just fantastic just when you have that opportunity. When you're standing in the field, all as you can see is green, but when you're looking down on top of it, it's just fantastic. Okay, so I'm going to finish there. I really just want to thank the group on the with the root rot pathogen, my postdoc, but there's also James Rogers, who's at the meeting, Corey Moffat and Kieran Mysore, and Kieran's postdoc, Prasanna. And I mentioned some of Kelly Craven's work and his people, and I just have a great group of people that work with me on the endophytes. So I'm happy to take any questions. It hasn't been identified in the north. I don't know, would you like some soil? You can take it back and see. My understanding is just that maybe it doesn't like the cold winters. You know, there's a lot of challenges there with it. There's something very much about our soils that seem to, it's very much endemic there. So I don't know the difference or why it wouldn't be prevalent up there. So plant breeding, we've spent a lot of time looking at that, and they have in cotton as well. This is a pathogen that's been known for over 100 years, and they have tried breeding for resistance all over that time, and there has never successfully been any breeding for resistance. Whatever its mechanism is, and once again, once we kind of can get hold of a decent genome of it, and we can start looking at that plant-microbe interaction, maybe we can start understanding some of this. What is its arsenal against the plant, and how does it have such a broad host range? So. We do believe that the disease took out that plant, and in fact, actually, as I was driving along the road, it's just a road you drive out to work, I looked over and I went, wow, that tree is dead, and those plants are dying. The tree died the season before, but we do believe that it was the same pathogen. It was a Bradford pear. So yes, I think that's a really good question, and yes, to some degree it is. If you take away the ergot alkaloids of that association, and there are natural isolates that don't produce ergot alkaloids, you have to manage that pasture better. Those animals, those cows, will graze it right down to the bare bone because they have nothing stopping them from saying, I don't want to eat you anymore. So think about it as a bioactive alkaloid that's actually helping protect the pasture. But it then becomes a management, and farmers can manage. So.